Well, it was good to be a part of a chorus of amens when the prayer was finished this morning instead of having to say a solo like I have been doing this past week. One of the things I appreciate about this congregation is the amens when the prayer is said, and I believe it's a perfectly scriptural arrangement by which those who agree with the prayer, as it were, sign it by saying, so be it. Other interesting things we experienced this past week, I mentioned before I left, we'd be working with the church with which I worked before I moved to Embry Hill the first time. It's been 21 years since we left. But there are still a great many people there that we have loved and appreciated so much. It was a joy indeed to see little children that I had in Bible classes and now among the leaders of the congregation, and to see some who were weak when I was there who have grown stronger. Experience very similar to what I had in Romulus, Michigan. Of course, also the sadness, as nearly always is experienced when you go back after a period of years at seeing some who were strong in the Lord, who now have either quit or have apostatized in various ways. That's part, it seems, of the history of churches. May God help us to avoid that in this congregation. But most of all, may He help you and me to avoid allowing such a thing to happen in our own lives. We personally are responsible before God and must maintain our faith and our loyalty to the Lord. It is good to be back, and I just pray that our study together today will be beneficial and edifying. Glad to have some visitors. I would like to commend the Finleys who came by yesterday afternoon. I was outside here, and they had found the building, checking on the time of the services so they would not be late. They were here good and early for Bible classes this morning. And whenever you go somewhere, if you possibly can, check out the location of the church building in advance and find out the time of the services and just plunge in as fully as you can into the activities of that congregation while you are among them. Many of you do that, but I certainly commend that practice to you. I hope that before very long we can have a series of lessons from the 12th chapter of the book of Romans. Without doubt, it is one of the most practical, useful, encouraging books and chapters in all the Bible. But this morning I'm going to rush ahead just a little bit and think with you about one particular verse. Romans, the 12th chapter, and I want us to look at verse 11. Perhaps in order to get the background, we should begin back with verse 9. And read through verse 13. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another. And then our verse, not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. You can see readily how a very lengthy series of lessons could be presented on that, each one of them edifying in the daily life that we live. But I want you to think particularly about this verse 11. Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. It seems to me that we need this teaching particularly in our present time. There has developed among us, and I think quite a lot is being said about it, a rather sloppy, lackadaisical kind of attitude about everything. We do not seem to be concerned about excellence in anything. It's not uncommon, if you wish to take your automobile for repair, to have them tell you to be ready a certain time, and it's not. To tell you that it's repaired, and you get out and it does just exactly what it was doing before. It's not uncommon to have promises broken concerning the time when people will come and do work for you. In fact, it's almost surprising when they do come. Tardiness is so very common in school and the workplace, and I'd have to say even in our services. People just don't seem to care. And the interesting thing is that we all can be affected by that, even those of us who complain when we see it in other people. Some years ago, in a place where I was living, there was a brother in the church who worked for the city. And he was in charge of four or five men who worked in the streets and cleaning and various other tasks of that kind. I drove up one day about noon to see city workers all over my yard, my front yard, out there under the tree, eating their lunch. And when I went in, this brother was there in the house. Well, we had a nice visit, but it went on for 30 minutes, 45, an hour. And I thought about all those city employees out there under the trees working, not working, but sitting there eating their lunch and talking and laughing and in some instances, I think, sleeping. Well, I figured, well, it's been about an hour. Surely he'll be leaving. But he stayed and stayed and stayed. Another 15 minutes, another 30 minutes. Well, I was enjoying the conversation, but I was still concerned about all those workers. And about the time he'd been there maybe an hour and a half, he started talking about the fact that people that work for the city just don't care whether they do anything or not, it looked like to him. They were just so lazy and so laid back, and they didn't seem to feel any responsibility to give an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and he just went on and on and on and on about how little diligence was being shown in the people and workers for the city particularly. And there they were still out there, all four or five of them besides himself, just taking a very, very long lunch hour. Well, I think that many times when we see other people doing that, we think, well, I'm not that way. Of course, now today, well, I can be late today, or I can loaf today, or I can be just a little dishonest today, or I can break this promise today. But now that's not my usual way of doing things. Of course, life is made up of what I do today and tomorrow and day by day. And so many times we see ourselves as being diligent when in fact we're not diligent. I don't know what the causes are. It may be permissive parents who do not teach their children diligence. It may be schools that do not maintain discipline. It may be laws that protect the lazy. But whatever the reason, Christians must rise above it. This passage of Scripture says that Christians must not be lagging in diligence. The King James Version has an interesting translation there. It says, not slothful in business. That word slothful didn't mean anything to me until I saw a sloth. And it became a very meaningful thing. It'd be interesting. How many of you have ever seen a sloth? Raise your hand. Oh, nearly everybody has. So I don't need to spend much time telling you about the sloth. But I suspect you never saw one running a race. They hang down under the limb. They're just too lazy to stand up on it. And any movements they make are just so very slow that it just looks like they're not going to get anything done. And they really don't get anything much done. Even as stubborn as a mule is, he gets a whole lot more done than a sloth does. A sloth just doesn't accomplish anything. And that's the word, not slothful in business. How do you conduct your business? Do you conduct it with energy and with diligence? Or do you conduct it like a sloth? Now this passage of Scripture, particularly the King James translation, seems to be referring to our secular life. And the fact is that our secular life should be diligently pursued by Christians. The Bible even teaches that, I think. It's interesting that the Bible talks about slaves. And if there would be anybody who would be tempted to be lazy, if he could get by with it, it surely would be a slave. But in Titus, the second chapter, in verse 9, Paul wrote to Titus, exhort servants to be obedient to their masters, to be well-pleasing in all things, not answering back, not pilfering, but showing all good fidelity. Now, there is a description of the opposite of one who is slothful in business. Notice again. He's to seek to please his master, to be obedient to his master. He doesn't talk back. He doesn't steal. He shows all faithfulness in fulfilling the desires of his master and seeking the well-being and the welfare of his master. Now, if God requires that of a slave, how much more would he require it of one who was free, of one who had made the choice to work for this particular employer? the one who had made the choice to pursue this particular profession. God expects us, whatever we do, to do it well. I literally believe that what we're saying here is the same thing that's said in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. We have a statement that has come into our English language as a kind of a proverb. If a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing right. And I believe that that's a principle that is supported by Bible teaching. Do it right. Now, I believe this does apply in secular business, but I think it has a broader application. I believe it applies to a mother in the home. As a mother, do the very best job you can do of being a mother. If you're a wife, do the best job you can do of being a wife. As a husband, put something into being a husband. Think about how you can improve your performance as a husband. How you can make the household operate a little more smoothly and a little more efficiently. As a mother and a wife, think about how you can keep the house just a little bit better. Always be striving for excellence. In fact, Paul commended the Philippians because they pursued the things that were excellent, took thought for things that were excellent. Excellence is something that we have lost sight of in this generation, but something that we need to see once more as an ideal to be achieved. If you're a student in school, seek to do what is excellent. Try to be a good student. Not only an orderly student who doesn't cause problems, but one who studies. One who tries to make the best of a project that may be assigned to you. You may not be as artistic as some others. I can remember when I was in school and I was assigned a project. Sometimes things were brought in that I could no more have made than anything in the world. I couldn't paint a picture as good as somebody else had. I certainly couldn't make a little science project that was as remarkable as some of the science projects that the children brought in. But there was one thing my mother kept on telling me you can do. You can do the best you can do. Be excellent. Do the best. I believe that's God's will for every one of us in whatever we may undertake. But I suspect that the primary application of this is intended to be in the Lord's work, that we should be diligent in doing the Lord's work. This would fit with what we have back up in the earlier part of the chapter. And I'm going to read it from the New International Version. There are a number of efforts at translating this passage, and I'm not sure any of them really bring out exactly what's in it. But the NIV, beginning with verse 6, says, "We have different gifts according to the grace that is given to us. If a man's gift is prophesying, let him use it in proportion to his faith. If it is serving, let him serve. If it is teaching, let him teach. If it is encouraging, let him encourage. If it is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. If it is leadership, let him govern diligently. If it is showing mercy, let him do it cheerfully." I believe what that's saying is, just do the best you can at whatever your gift may be, whatever it is you can do. And these do not seem to me, as the most of them, to be miraculous gifts. Some of them are, but many of them are gifts that we have naturally. And he says, whatever you can do in the Lord's service, just make sure that you do the very best job you can do of that thing. Put everything into it of which you are capable. And I think we could say that a preacher ought to do the very best job every time he gets up to preach as effectively and as with as much edification and encouragement to righteousness as he possibly can. Most people agree with that. They want the preacher. And yet some people that seem to me to just insist that a preacher be well prepared, that he present a meaningful and encouraging lesson and a helpful lesson every time, get so sloppy with a lot of other things. I see Bible class teachers that will come and go, "Well, I didn't have any time to prepare, but we'll do the best we can to get through this passage of Scripture." That is inexcusable in doing the Lord's work. Of course, I'm not too sure that there's a lot of difference in the teacher doing that kind of thing and those who come to the classes doing what they do. Just the other day, as I was opening up the annex over here, I started calculating the cost of that. Now, we think we came out pretty well, and I think most of you would agree. I think that the total cost was about $40,000, and we can get most of it back if we decide to turn it in. But I just got to thinking about a $40,000 expenditure for approximately two uses a week of about 45 minutes each use, an hour and a half. That's expensive. That's expensive. Now let me tell you, if the teachers are well prepared and the students really concentrate while they're there for 45 minutes, while they're there for the entire period of time, if they really concentrate, if they really learn, if they really make application to their lives, if they're changed by what they've learned, it's worth every penny of it. I don't regret one dime that went into it. But oh, what a waste if we spend that money to provide a building into which we just go and sort of wrap, just sort of exchange what we've already been thinking about and really not learn anything at all. Not only should Bible class teachers and Bible students be diligent, but elders certainly have the responsibility to be diligent in what they're doing. I see elders in various places who seem to take very little responsibility for the work that they're due to do. Just go for long periods of time without even talking together about the needs of the church and the work that they need to be doing. Deacons should be extremely diligent in what they're doing as deacons. It's an important work. A congregation needs thoughtful, vigilant consideration of needs and fulfillment of responsibilities. And a deacon can be a great asset to a church if he is diligent in what he does. Song leaders need to lead diligently. They need to prepare their songs, not simply getting the numbers together, but being sure they know the songs. I've been amazed sometime at the difference in the same man when he is prepared to lead a song and when he has really not made any preparation. We used to have a song leaders contest when I was in school, and some of the fellows that just really were, seemed to me not to be very good song leaders, at that song leaders contest would just do excellent. Why? Well, they had prepared. They would get their songs 24 hours in advance, and you'd see them walking across the campus, and they were singing, and they had their pitch pipe, and they were walking across the campus, beating time. They're getting ready for that. Well, let me tell you, every time we stand up to lead a song, we're doing something in the service of God, and there's reason for us to be diligent in what we do along that line. The preparation of the communion, reading the Bible publicly, every activity that we engage in the service of God should be done with diligence, as efficiently, as effectively, as well as we can possibly do that thing. You know, that's a trait of character that I believe God expects in Christians. Jesus most certainly demonstrated it to perfection. And in being Christ-like, I believe we will be diligent. But on what basis is this diligence? Is it simply because we've always been taught that we are supposed to do things right? You know, there's some families that really stress that in rearing children. Or is it because we have so much pride that we would be totally embarrassed if something we did was not done so that it would be acceptable to other people? Is that the basis of our diligence? I don't believe so. Not in this text. I believe that the basis of our diligence is the fact that we are fervent in spirit. We are really excited about this thing that we're doing. You can tell the difference when people do something diligently just because they're supposed to do it diligently, maybe because they're going to get a grade on it in school, or maybe because their job depends on it. You can tell a difference in that and when somebody does something just because they love to do it. They're just so excited. They are so enthusiastic about this particular thing that they just naturally put their whole self into the thing. And I believe that God intends for us to be diligent in and fervent in spirit. Now, we can find illustrations of fervency of spirit, zeal, enthusiasm, love for something in the sports field very easily, can't we? We see people that just get so excited about baseball or football, and I have seen people go out to play golf when I could not believe they would go out there. As hot as come in, just absolutely red in the face, sweat pouring, just worn out, but they're right ready to go the next day. It doesn't matter how hot it is, or it doesn't matter much how cold it is, or how rainy it is. If there's any way in the world they can get out, here they go. And fishing, I have seen people get up long before daylight and go out there on a cold, rainy morning and nearly freeze to death to keep a line in the water to catch fish. That's enthusiasm. That's fervency of spirit. But how many of us have that kind of fervency of spirit in the work of the Lord? God desires a fervent spirit. In Revelation, the 3rd chapter, in verses 15 and 16, very familiar verses, the Lord dictated a letter to the church in Laodicea. And after saying to them that he was the faithful and true witness, couldn't find anything good to say about them, he said, "I know your works." Maybe that was good, that they had some work. But apparently their work was not done because of a fervent spirit. They just kind of went through the motions, apparently. Because he says, "I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot." You know, people that are cold can sometimes be shaken. They know they need some heat. They know they need some life about them. But if people are just lukewarm, they feel pretty good about themselves. They don't feel they need to make any improvement. But God says, if you're not going to be hot, I wish you'd be cold. I'd rather you be cold. He said, if there's anything I hate, it's lukewarmness. And I guess I'd have to say that. I'd rather have a cup of hot water than a lukewarm cup of water. My preference is usually cold water. But if it's not going to be one or the other, don't make it lukewarm. And the Lord said, I just don't want lukewarmness. And that would be people who are not fervent in spirit. Now, I want to say this, that when you really are fervent in spirit, when you are zealous, when you're enthusiastic about religion, there are a lot of people that are going to think about you just about the same way I think about a fellow that get up before daylight and go out fishing in 30 degree weather. They're not going to understand it. They're going to think that you have just absolutely lost your marbles, or at least they've all rolled over on one side, as one fellow said. They're going to think you're crazy. And you won't be the first one about whom that is thought. In fact, Jesus, we read this morning where Jesus was, his parents, his mother came, he came to him. And do you know why? Matthew doesn't tell us, but Luke does, or Mark rather. Mark tells us that his mother and apparently his brethren had decided they just better go out and rescue him from himself. They said he's beside himself. He's going to ruin his health. I hear some mothers talking that way. He's going to ruin his health. He's beside himself. He's gone crazy. He's obsessed. Well, sure he was, but it was good. His enemies were not quite so kind. They said he has a demon. He's working with a demon. And about Paul, they said, well, they said, much learning hath run you crazy. They just couldn't understand the zeal, the enthusiasm that he had for the Lord. And people that, well, maybe don't even believe in God. And certainly people that don't believe in heaven and hell. And people who really have never really given serious thought to the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for them personally. People who live for money, people who live for fame, people who live for pleasure will never understand your fervency, your zeal, your enthusiasm for spiritual things. Your fervency of spirit. But you just go on and have it. You go on and have it. Well, why? How can you get that enthusiastic? Well, the fact is, it is because you are serving the Lord. Serving the Lord. Now, it may seem strange that a person would find it joyful to serve. This is the idea of slavery. A slave, how could he be joyful in serving a master? The word Lord here is significant. Master. Well, there are a number of things. I think we find joy in serving those we love. You see a mother preparing for her children to come home for dinner, a homecoming, and she'll work and work and work and do it joyfully because she loves them and she finds joy in preparing for their coming. Now, if we love Jesus as we ought to love Him, then serving Him will be a joy, and we'll be fervent in spirit in doing it, and we'll be diligent in doing it. Not only that, but we find joy in serving those we admire. If you genuinely admire someone, and you just kind of have them up on a pedestal a little bit, and they suggest to you that you can do something for them, you're just delighted to do it. You feel honored that they would request you to do this. Do we not admire the Lord? Does He not stand on a pedestal higher than any other? And we certainly rejoice in serving those to whom we owe some debt. There are people here in this very audience this morning who have done so many kind things for me that it would thrill me to know that there was something I could do for you. The Lord has done so much for us. Think what a debt we owe to Him. And is it not a joy to be able to express in some way our love for Him, our gratitude to Him for what He's done for us? Well, as I'm glad you didn't leave out one of the stanzas of that song. I'm always glad when you announce it. It's such a beautiful song. He saw me plunged in deep distress and flew to my relief. For me, He bore the shameful cross and carried all my grief. And then, I don't know if you know what that little asterisk means by a stanza or not, but it means that you may leave this one out. But I'm so glad we didn't. To Him I owe my life and breath and all the joys I have. He makes me triumph over death and saves me from the grave. And then the thought of serving the Lord with fervency and diligence. Since from Thy bounty I receive such proofs of love divine, had I 1,000 hearts to give, Lord, they should all be Thine. Doesn't that make sense? Isn't that reasonable? Could you hold back anything from Him who has done so much for us? We're serving the Lord. And really, that should affect all the other things that we do. Even if we are slaves, to say nothing of free servants, individuals who have accepted some kind of a job. In the sixth chapter of the book of Ephesians, beginning with verse 5, he says, "Servants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart as to Christ. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men." When you're out there on the job, whether it's a job as a salesman or whether it's a job as a computer programmer, or whether it's a job as a worker on a farm for someone who is your master, your boss, whether it's working in the house, whatever it may be you're doing, consider that you are doing it to the Lord, for the Lord, because the Lord has told you to do it. Many times your boss, your employer, your husband, your parents, various ones, don't deserve what you do. But the Lord does. And you can find joy and enthusiasm and a desire to be diligent simply by thinking properly. Not thinking, I'm doing this for that mean old no count, no good husband of mine, or for those unreasonable parents, or for that terrible boss, but I'm doing this for the Lord. And that changes the whole picture. It changes everything. And if we think in those terms, it's going to make a major difference. As parents, as husbands, as wives, as children, whatever, think of doing what we do for the Lord. And that will increase our diligence and even our zeal, our enthusiasm, our fervency of spirit in the things that we do. And certainly, what we do in the assembly, what we do for the Lord's church, is done for Him. It is our gift. It is a way of indicating our love, our gratitude to Him. And this certainly should affect the manner in which we do it. But let me ask one final question. Some people, it just seems like, are by nature just enthusiastic and zealous and hyper almost and whatever they go about doing. But not all of us can be that way. Well, really, it didn't say anything about being hyper, did it? I've found sometime that the people that get all hyper about something today, may be either just complete flat out tomorrow, or they may be gone off hyper about something else. You know, if it's just a kind of a natural way we are, I don't know that it's necessarily good. And sometimes the person who don't seem so hyper are the ones that can get the most done. I've observed that. I worked with a preacher once, rather closely, living with him, working with him, and in fact, I think of two or three examples of that. And never seemed like he was doing very much at any given time. And yet, at the close of a year, you look back to see, and he had accomplished so very much. He just went about it quietly. But he went about it with diligence. And he went about it with a fervent spirit, which wasn't all that showing energy. Sometimes we show so much energy in our movements and activities and rapid speech and everything that there's no energy left for the really accomplishing of something of significance. But you say, well, that's just not my nature. How could I build this fervency of spirit? How could I increase my zeal? You can. I think I may have used this illustration some time ago, but looks like we have some people here that weren't here then. I knew a fella up in Ohio that was extremely enthusiastic about skunks. I doubt that he had always been enthusiastic about skunks. I suspect he'd been about as unenthusiastic as I am about skunks. But somehow or other, he got it in his head that he could make some money with skunks and ferrets. And so he got busy and learned everything he could learn about skunks. And he took some kind of training to know how to take care of the most objectionable characteristics of a skunk. And he started then putting money into skunks. And when I was there, he just had cage after cage after cage after cage of skunks. He must have had 100 or 150 of them. And he had ferrets. And he was enthusiastic about it. Why? Well, in the first place, he thought there could be some benefit for him. And believing that, he just put everything he had into it. And I was reminded of something Jesus said, certainly not talking about skunks, but he said, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. If you are not as enthusiastic and zealous as you ought to be about the Lord's work, then my suggestion would be that you just make a conscious, objective, intellectual decision that you're going to put everything you can into it. And once you begin to do that, money, sure, contribute liberally. Make a sacrifice. Put whatever you can get your hands on to accomplish some good work that you know of that needs to be done. But not only money, put yourself into it. Get involved. Show that interest that you can decide to show. And the first thing you know, you will be so excited about serving the Lord, it'll just become a major part of your life. And you'll begin to reap those benefits that most certainly are there for those who truly serve Him effectively. Do you look sometime at people you know who have just served the Lord and reaped so many benefits? One of the joys of this past week was seeing Brother Bruce Crawley, who is now a member of the congregation there, though he was an elder for many, many years at 77th Street. And Willis more or less gives Brother Crawley credit for much of his activity in the Lord, encouragement Brother Crawley gave. But he is such a happy man. Happiness just reigns in his face, even though he has to be brought in a wheelchair and sat back in a big chair that will push him up and get him out easily. And he really can't do a lot of things, but he is happy as he can be, and people are just swarming around him, trying to do things for him. You see that and wish you could have it? Well, just be that kind of person. Just put your treasure into it. And those benefits and that derive from being a faithful servant of God will begin to be yours. And you can develop an enthusiasm for it if you simply determine to put your heart into it. Your treasure will precede. When your treasure's there, your heart will be. Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Is there one this morning who will make that decision? It's your decision to make. Don't say, God didn't make me this way. Don't say, well, in view of the things that have happened in my life, I can't be that way. Yes, you can be. It's simply a matter of a decision that I will put my treasure into serving the Lord. And when you start putting your treasure there, I guarantee your heart will be there. And once your heart is there, then there won't be any difficulty in putting your treasure there. It will just come naturally. And so there is a cycle. The more you put into it, the more enthusiastic you are. The more enthusiastic you are, the easier it is to serve the Lord. You look now when you think of being a Christian at having to give up some things. But you give them up for the Lord, and you'll find it a delight in days to come. And you can't experience that. Or you can't understand that, I should say, until you experience it. I wonder if there's one here this morning who, by faith in the Lord, will repent of sins and come to the Lord in obedience and baptism. Or perhaps there's the need for some public statement of a rededication to the Lord, a confession of past sins, and a determination to be faithful to Him. If we can assist you in any way in that direction, we ask you to come and let us know as we stand and sing.